Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. President Biden opened his virtual summit for democracy today.
In the face of sustained and alarming challenges to democracy, universal human rights, and all around the world, democracy needs champions.
The two-day event, with about 110 invited countries, fulfills a Biden campaign promise to gather together a summit meant to defend against rising authoritarianism around the world.
And I wanted to host this summit because here in the United States, we know as well as anyone that renewing our democracy and strengthening our democratic institutions requires constant effort.
Democracy is in measurable retreat in the United States, and the world knows it. According to a Pew Global Attitudes survey this spring, among foreigners polled in more than a dozen countries, only roughly 17% saw the U.S. as a good model for democracy. We seem to know it, too. Among Americans polled, 72% said this nation is no longer a shining model of democratic governance. There are other measures as well. A decade ago, the nonprofit group Freedom House, which conducts research on democracy and political freedom, gave the U.S. 94 out of 100 in its Freedom in the World report. This year, that number dropped to 83 because of, quote, partisan political pressure on the electoral process and growing disparities in wealth, economic opportunity, and political influence, end quote. Opening his virtual summit on democracy today, Biden gave a slight nod to that current erosion, but he turned more enthusiastically to American history.
American democracy is an ongoing struggle to live up to our highest ideals and to heal our divisions, to recommit ourselves to the founding idea of our nation, captured in our Declaration of Independence, not unlike many of your documents. We say we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all women and men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, among them life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Democracy doesn't happen by accident. We have to renew it with each generation. And this is an urgent matter on all our parts, in my view.
Well, once the effervescence settles down, it's worth taking a closer look at exactly how Americans in the past struggled to protect and renew their democracy. Were they as successful as Biden suggests? Does that history hint at how Americans might preserve their democracy now? That's what we're going to talk about today. And to do so, Jack Beatty joins us. He's On Point's news analyst. Hello there, Jack.
Hello, Meghna.
And of course, listeners should know that, Jack, you've written extensively, by the way, about the particular period we're going to look at today, most specifically in your book, Age of Betrayal, The Triumph of Money in America from 1865 to 1900. I'm very happy to give a plug for that book, Jack. So
I'm happy too.
Well, also with us today is John Grinspan. He's curator of political history at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History and author of the new book about that same time period. It's called The Age of Acrimony: How Americans Fought to Fix Their Democracy, 1865 to 1915. John Grinspan, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me. I'm a fan of the show and of Jack's writing on American history, so this is a real pleasure.
Well, what I'd like to do—
Mr. Grinspan, thank you.
What I'd like to do is start with both of you kind of in the here and now and what you heard just there in Biden's opening remarks at his summit for democracy. And Jack, let me actually just start with you. You know, there is a sense that Americans should look to their history for inspiration on how to manage the struggles of the present. But the very fact that there has to be a summit on democracy in order to try to rally, lock arms, as Biden said, to protect it, is kind of concerning enough.
It is indeed. And as you say, the vagary there and the loftiness seem to be a kind of defense against the reality, which here, I think The New Yorker well expressed when Donald Trump was taking office, that his presidency represented a crisis to democracy. Well, that crisis wasn't adjourned when he left office. To the contrary, it has worsened. And we see clearly a future ahead where the Republican Party is tempted, and more than tempted, ready to succumb to an authoritarian leader who seems to have no regard for democracy, certainly for elections. And as we look back in our past, I can't see any parallel to that except that of the Southerners, the slaveholders, the slave power in the 1850s, people who wanted minority rule at any cost.
Mm. Well, of course, then we all know what that led to, right, come 1861. John Grinspan, your thoughts on the fact that, you know, Biden did remark today that American democracy is an ongoing struggle. What do you think?
Well, I think acknowledging that is key. And I think we need to see that it's not kind of a light switch. We'll have democracy or we won't have democracy. It's a metaphor we're using a lot. It's more of a dimmer throughout American history. The kind of the engagement, popular engagement, and the norms of democracy rise and fall. And I do think we have a tendency to say Americans are more divided than that we've ever been since the Civil War and point to the Civil War. And we all worry about we could see our democracy going towards a direction like that. But we also have precedents from later in the 19th century of incredible political acrimony, incredible political anger, you know, violence in the streets on a level that we still, you know, would find shocking to Americans in 2021. And yet they managed to turn down the volume on it. And they made some trade-offs. They didn't make everything better. But we do have errors in our past where things – we can see people calming down in the past as well as people amping up. And I think learning about that history is incredibly valuable as we think about how to reform our democracy again today.
Okay, so that's exactly why having both of you on the program today is truly going to help us meet that goal. What can we learn specifically from this period of just after the Civil War, so 1865, to the early 1900s? Again, Jack wrote about it in The Age of Betrayal, and John, you wrote about it in your new book, The Age of Acrimony. So we have multiple ages here. Mm-hmm. But Jack, in order to sort of set the stage for how tumultuous that period was, I wonder if I can to lean on your poetic passions here. Okay, so let's imagine the scene. Okay, it's 1896, an election year, and here's the place: Springfield, Illinois, and here's what 19th century politics felt like to a then 16-year-old boy who, Jack, as you told me, with his best girl, joined a crowd of 20,000 people to cheer on William Jennings Bryan, the boy orator of the Platte. Now, Bryan was just what? Just over 35 and a candidate for the president of the United States. And that boy in that crowd, Vachel Lindsay, later wrote a poem, an epic poem called Bryan, 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 Bryan. Now, Jack, give us a little taste of this poem.
Sure. In a nation of 100 fine, mob-hearted, lynching, relenting, repenting millions, there are plenty of sweeping, swinging, stinging, gorgeous things to shout about and knock your old blue devils out. I brag and chant a Bryan, 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 candidate for president who sketched a silver Zion, the one American poet who could sing outdoors. He bought in tides of wonder, of unprecedented splendor, wild roses from the plains that made hearts tender. All the funny circus silks of politics unfurled, Bartlett pears of romance that were honey at the cores, and torchlights down the street to the end of the world.
Oh my God, a circus silks and wild roses from the plains? Jack, what is this telling you about the feeling that Americans had for their politics in the late 19th century?
Well, you know, some people say, well, it was just their television. It was their Netflix. The point is, it was mass. I mean, turnouts approached 80%. And I think that John is right, too, that there was another side to the turnout, another side to the torchlight parades. And that was anger and just acrimony and wanting to defeat the other guy. And in that regard, it was very like the negative polarization of our parties today.
Okay, so John Greenspan, Jack mentioned a critically important point that we're talking about a period of American history, a roughly 40-year period, where turnout in elections was 80%, and that was a regular occurrence. Tell us more about sort of the field of politics and how Americans engaged with it during this period.
Yeah, I mean, what makes this era so interesting to me and I think so relevant for our times is you have incredible engagement and incredible, if it's a word, enragement at the same time, that the good and the bad are so mixed up. This is an era when you have 80% turnout of eligible voters, and obviously a lot of people are not eligible to vote back then. All women, everyone under 21, African Americans in certain times and places. But everyone, even those people who can't vote, are still going to these rallies, going to these midnight spectacles and, you know, marching and reading the newspapers and arguing the issues. And you can see schoolgirls on the trolleys arguing about the best candidate for them. And there's really a grassroots engagement with democracy, especially among working class people, that the political system has higher turnout and higher engagement from people who are poorer and less well-educated at that point. It's really good at getting people to care about their democracy, at drumming up participation, at getting people in the streets, getting people to vote, getting people to really care deeply about the governance, which is one of the goals of democracy. But all that participation often comes at the sacrifice of civility at the same time. I mean, this is an era when 3 of the 4 presidential assassinations in our history happen, when a congressman is murdered every 7 years during this era, when these elections are incredibly high turnout, but also the closest in our history and are often stolen or go to the loser of the popular vote. So one of the reasons I find this era so fascinating is because you have the good and the bad and what we want and what we don't want for democracy so viscerally mixed up together. And I think it's present in that poem from the Bryan campaign, and it's present when you read the diaries and the letters of these young people. And we see elements of emerging today. I mean, we at the Smithsonian recently collected tiki torches from Charlottesville, that the people are marching with torches for the first time in 100 years. What does that tell us about our moment and how it connects to the past?
Well, John Greenspan and Jack Beatty, hang on for a moment, because when we come back, we're going to talk a lot more about the specifics, that the details of what both of you have studied deeply about this period of American history from 1865 to the early 1900s. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're taking a close look at an interesting period of American history, just after the Civil War, 1865 through the early 1900s, an era of a real surge of political engagement in this country, but also a huge amount of instability. And at that time, Americans asking if their own democracy was a failure. And I'm joined today by Jack Beattie. He's On Point News Analyst, and Jack has written extensively about this period in a terrific book from several years ago called The Age of Betrayal, The Triumph of Money in America, 1865 to 1900. And we're pairing Jack today with John Grinspan. He's curator of political history at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History, and he's out with a new book called The Age of Acrimony, How Americans Fought to Fix Their Democracy, 1865 to 1915. So, Jack, let me just turn back to you here quickly, because you heard John just before the break describe how even, you know, schoolgirls riding trolleys would vigorously debate American politics. But you asked a great question. I'd love to hear your own answer to it, Jack. I mean, was politics more sort of the Netflix of that time, more entertainment and engagement rather than political change?
Well, in that sense, yes, it was performative. It didn't lead to anything good for the average American. That really had to wait for the New Deal. The reformers of the era were trying to pull the New Deal through the sleeve of time, and they couldn't do it. And it was a period of corruption in government, unexampled corruption, government by campaign contributions. Henry D. Lloyd, he labeled the greenest legacy of Gilded Age politics. The publicity given corruption, it broadcast the death of hope. Nothing could be done with the unregenerate parties, and nothing could be done outside them.
Mm. Well, John Grinspan, I was wondering if you might sort of give us a glimpse into what the archives at the Smithsonian have revealed to you about this time. You had mentioned those diaries and letters. I mean, what were people saying from saloon keepers to those schoolgirls about American politics?
Yeah, so at the Smithsonian itself, we mostly have physical material stuff. So what you have from the era are things like torches from midnight rallies. We have hundreds of ballots from different campaigns because the parties printed their own ballots back then, and you have these ballots from these dirty and stolen elections. We have uniforms from these kind of youth partisan marching clubs that verge on kind of gangs sometimes or paramilitary organizations. There's this wealth of material object demonstrating this kind of vibrant forgotten past. And to go through the units and the cabinets and the drawers in the Smithsonian, you can see how vivid and vibrant this politics once was. And it's interesting to contrast it with, as you move along into the 20th century, the objects seem a little calmer and a little more restrained and a little more peaceful. And then when you dig into the diaries and the letters of people engaged in politics or just observing that are, you know, stored elsewhere, is democracy a failure? Is often the thing people kick around in the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s. Has democracy failed us? Can democracy be saved? Does universal suffrage work? Is this normal? Is something they kicked around a lot back then, in which we hear all the time today. What does a normal democracy look like? Is it one where people turn out in high numbers and engage, but also, you know, bash each other's heads in the street? Or is it one where people are restrained and calm, but maybe don't participate at the same level?
Can I just jump in here? Because you're talking a lot about behavior, but I'm still very taken by the fact that in the 1870s, people were asking, is democracy a failure? I mean, why were they asking that question? The nation had just emerged from a terrible war to preserve the very fact of the United States and, of course, eradicate slavery. But why would people be asking soon after that if democracy was a failure?
That's a great question. And I think part of it is that elation after the war, that if you look at America in 1865, a lot of people in the North, freed African Americans, start talking about pure democracy, that democracy has succeeded. They fought this war for democracy against slavery, against the Confederacy, and this will lead to a kind of a more diverse and integrated country, and are really excited and elated. And partially their excitement with how emancipation worked, how the Union succeeded in the war, sets them up for failure in the next couple of decades. Not that they shouldn't have been excited or fought for those goals, but as they get people who are so optimistic, as they get into the 1870s, 1880s, as they're not, you know, in the new millennium or whatever, and they haven't brought utopia, they have a kind of brittle sense of politics where if it's not solving all their problems, it must be entirely bad. And so there's kind of all or nothing in their engagement. A lot of people turn off, especially among kind of the wealthier educated classes. They say a gentleman never votes. It's not worth engaging in this kind of working class democracy in the streets. And they start claiming democracy has failed them. Now, partially they're saying that because they're losing the elections. So democracy is always failing the side that's losing. I think the other thing that's really powering a lot of this is the more they engage, the angrier they get. That people keep saying, well, if we just win this next election, if we just defeat the opposite side next time, we'll kind of come to this moment of utopia and we'll solve all our problems. But the more these parties bash each other's heads in and the more they win elections, really, you know, 1,000 voters in New York decide an election, the angrier they get and the harder it is to make any of those reforms. Jack's exactly right. These parties don't do much constructively for the American people for decades. They take their votes, but they don't really help them that much because they're so focused on partisan combat. And we have a model of how change should happen, which is we all turn out, we all vote, and we fix things. But we can see from this era, people can turn out in huge numbers and vote and make things worse also. So I think we, as we consider this era in our own time, we need to be a little more reflective of what a good democracy looks like.
Yeah. So, Jack, I definitely want to hear you on this because I'm also mindful of the fact that we have, you know, the failures of Reconstruction going on. And, I mean, this is the Gilded Age we're talking about. So how does that, you know, that the rampant inequality that rises during this time factor into the both the passions people had around politics, Jack, and the visceral disappointments?
Well, of course, the thorn of race pierces to the heart of the age. It's really about the, you know, the betrayal of the freedmen by the Republican Party. By the North, in the name of reunion. North and South joined at the marriageable daughter. That's sort of the image of let's forget the past. And, of course, the past meant leave the freedmen to the untender mercies of the Ku Klux Klan. But on the other side, you see, you have this as what you're referring to really as the plutocracy at the end of this period. Rutherford B. Hayes, the president, but he was also wounded, I think, 5 times in the Shenandoah Valley. War hero, Rutherford B. Hayes said, "We are no longer a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. We are a government of the corporation, for the corporation, and by the corporation." That was the sense of the betrayal. And its connection to race was grotesque because the 14th Amendment, which was supposed to guarantee equal protection of the laws to the freedmen, was turned by the Supreme Court into an instrument to, first of all, grant personhood to the corporation and then grant it the kinds of rights that were supposed to have been granted to the freedmen. A betrayal beyond scale in American jurisprudence.
Well, John Greenspan, you've written about how that inequality and the concomitant instability that came along with it is one of the things that pushed people into the hyper-partisan froth that you're describing, kind of marks the late 19th century's political climate.
Yeah, I mean, we can see in our own era and back then that inequality correlates to kind of partisanship, aggression. All these things can be charted on kind of a big U curve where they're really high in the late 19th century, calmed in the 20th century, and have increased in our own time. And it just makes sense on the ground. If you look at the lives of 19th century Americans, many of them are really disrupted. They're living in an era of incredible change in the Gilded Age, or, you know, people who are born on farms are working in factories and cities. People who are born in Ireland or Russia are living in Chicago or San Francisco. People who grew up in communities, you know, attending churches or synagogues and participating in folk traditions are completely uprooted and living in different worlds. People who were born in slavery are trying to make freedom for themselves. There's a lot of disruption, and some of it are ultimately forces for good, but a lot of people feel let loose, disrupted, unstable, lacking allies or institutions. And the two institutions that really want people in the 19th century are the political parties. They need votes. They need people to do all the hard work of campaigns. They need thugs to go throw bricks at the other side. These parties want people, more than the billionaires do, more than the corporations do, more than most other institutions in society. And so if you're a young person who moving to America, join the Democratic Party. You can go to the saloon, you can sing the songs, you can vote for them. If you were born in Georgia and you move to California, the Republican Party is waiting for you to, you know, embrace you and introduce you to a community. So in their own era and in ours, disruption, instability, just simple loneliness connects people with parties. These parties need something, and there's an exchange going on. And so I think one of the reasons we're seeing engagement in politics the way we are today, that's similar to back then, is we're living in a similar age of disruption and inequality.
Well,
and
can I just jump in here? Jack, do you agree with that? Because, I mean, I would think that the corporations and the industrialists wanted people too, but for their labor, not in a way that might make them feel emotionally good.
Oh, well, that's indeed the case. And they, you know, the sort of Pluto populism that is characteristic of the Republican Party today, on the one hand, benefactions for the rich, you know, boodle in the tax cuts and so on, coupled with appealing to the lowest feeling of grievance and resentment in rural Americans, that was perfected by the Republican Party in the 19th century, where they appealed to the bloody shirt. Every time there'd be some talk of uniting the working people, the farmers of the South, the industrial workers of the North in one party, as happened with the New Deal, every time that would come up, the Republicans would wave that bloody shirt and say, "Vote as you shot. You shot at those rebels. Vote against them. Vote against those darn Democrats." And that exploitation worked. And on the other side, the Democrats in the South said, "Vote as you shot. Vote against those Yankees." And so culture and memory held the present hostage.
Wow. You know, in listening to both of you and reading your works, I have to say, I did not realize how strong the parallels were between this post-Civil War period and now. Because, John, in the New York Times, you wrote a sort of a distillation of your book, and you write there that Americans saw weaker family ties, had fewer communal institutions, spent more time alone. And according to an observer, Americans had to cling to something. Now, that word rings loudly in my ears, does it not? I mean, even the language that is used to describe, that observers, in this case, how it echoes in current histories, of course, with Barack Obama, but even the language is the same, John.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I should preface all this by saying they lived in a very different era with some very different concerns. But there are these tendencies and trends, and you can see them on a real human level when you read their writings, their letters and their diaries. And when people who hate both parties talk about how they feel like there's nowhere for them to go, people who are frustrated with the political system looking for allies, there's the emotions they feel, the way they respond to their democracy and talk about their democracy and fret about the future of their republic, it really strikes a chord with how we talk today. And there are huge differences, but the kind of the fundamental concerns, what they call the certain dangerous tendencies in democracy, are things I think we're worrying about today. Can we get people to care without getting them to fight? Can we, you know, get a representative and proportionate voting? Can we kind of control the powerful forces of party and wealth who misrepresent the kind of popular voice? And can we get the popular voice to be productive and engage in a useful way? A lot of the things they worry about and they fright about back then, we've seen return to the point that, as somebody studying this, because I thought it was an interesting and different era, it's been shocking to see these trends and these tactics reemerge. You know, the voter suppression, some of these political attempts, all this rhetoric that I thought was 120 years old and was interesting because it was so different is now interesting because it's relevant. It's been striking to see this change.
Now, in a few minutes, we're going to get to really how they, quote unquote, fixed their democracy at the time. But John, I wanted to give you a minute or two here to describe some of the central characters in your book. There's particularly a father-daughter team that you write about that I'd never heard of. Can you tell us their story?
Yeah, I believe history is about people. And this father-daughter family and this relationship just seem to tell so much about this, these kind of big social and statistical trends of the era. The father is a guy named William Kelly. People called him Pig Iron Kelly. He was a radical congressman from Philadelphia. And he fought in the 19th century for abolition, for workers' rights, for a lot of causes along those lines, for women's suffrage. And he had a daughter named Florence Kelly, who's a little bit better known, who was a labor activist in the early 20th century and really played a key role in fighting against child labor and for social security and also for women's suffrage, and helped, was one of the founders of the NAACP. And their story is interesting to me because they had similar values. He really raised his daughter, even at a time when she couldn't vote or hold office, to fight for the same values as him, for protecting working people and underrepresented people. And you could see over years, as kind of democracy got harder, as people found new ways to make change, their relationship kind of mapped onto their democracy and the what was going on in their republic. So at times when people are really there's a lot of acrimony and people are really tense, they're bickering and they're at each other's throats. And at times when it looks like there's some path forward, they're writing letters and arguing at the dinner table about what change must be made. And also they just connected to everybody. They're friends with Frederick Douglass and Abe Lincoln and W.B. Du Bois and Jane Addams and all these figures from that era. So their life and their struggles and their complicated father-daughter relationship made them this kind of dynasty of democracy that could help, you know, kind of on a human scale, understand these big changes.
Okay. And so tell me quickly before we have to take this next break, what's one of the main sort of veins of understanding you draw from them then?
You can see how in different eras they just have to take different approaches to make change. And William Kelly makes change by campaigning and speechifying and legislating. And his daughter in a new era makes change by lobbying and behind the scenes and kind of avoiding democracy, not engaging with it. And that tells us a lot about how you make change in different eras and what works and what doesn't.
Okay, Jack, we've got about 30 seconds before the break. Did you want to comment on that?
Well, it's a terrific story told very well indeed, and it's a bloody story too. It opens with poor Pig Iron having his hand practically lacerated by an angry rebel or a Southerner is it the Willard Hotel? I don't know, someplace.
That's right, down the street.
Well, we're gonna take a quick break here, and then when we come back, we're gonna look at what lessons should we be drawing from this period, 1865 roughly to the early 1900s, about the fragility and therefore the protection of democracy in 2021. So we'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Just a little heads up on something we're working on for next week. We're going to be talking about staff shortages at America's public schools, in some places crippling shortages. I mean, there have been issues with teacher shortages, of course, but we'll also look at every other critical member of a school environment, substitutes, bus drivers, custodians, food service workers, and more, and how in some places those shortages have gotten so bad that schools have had to rethink their schedules and can't be open as much as they ought to be. So we want to know if this has been an issue in your public school. Have they had to call days off because of the staff shortages, or have they had to make programmatic or academic changes? And how is that affecting your children's experience in school? Tell us your story at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. 1-800-353-0683. That's for a program we're working on for next week. Today, we're taking a close look at a particular moment in American history. It's the period just after the Civil War, from 1865 to the early 1900s, a period of incredible political passions and fervor, and what lessons we might learn from the fact that then people were worried about American democracy, and what did they do to, quote-unquote, fix it. I'm joined today by Jack Beatty. He's On Point's news analyst. He's written extensively about this moment in American history, including in the terrific book Age of Betrayal, The Triumph of Money in America from 1865 to 1900. And John Grinspan joins us as well. He's a curator at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History, and he's got a new book called The Age of Acrimony, How Americans Fought to Fix Their Democracy, 1865 to 1915. Now, Jack, there's something that John wrote that I want to read to you briefly, because it kind of confuses me a little. And I have a specific reason to ask you about it, Jack. So John points out, and we heard earlier in the show, about how passionate people were about their democracy in this period. And he's written that the more demands Americans put on their democracy, in fact, the less they got. Quote, it was the locus for a culture war, a race war, and a class war. And by asking it, being politics, to provide public entertainment and small talk and family bonding, progress became impossible. Little change, now here's the thing, because so many were participating, not in spite of that. So, Jack, tell me a little bit more what you think about that. There must have been something then fundamentally broken about actual governance at the time, too, let alone that so many Americans, women, black Americans, weren't even allowed to vote at this time. But why was progress impossible even as so many were, quote unquote, participating?
Well, because it was government of the corporation, by the corporation, and for the corporation. It was government by boodle and corruption. You know, the whiskey scandal, the armor plate scandal, the this scandal, the that scandal. So the politicians put their hand out, they got their take, and this effectively they were working for the business class. And, you know, let's face it, the country was industrialized in this period. There was a trade-off. Barrington Moore, the great political sociologist, called it a revolution from above. And he makes the astute point, this is in his great book, The Social Origins of Dictatorship and Democracy. He writes, there is no evidence that the mass of the population anywhere has wanted an industrial society, and plenty of evidence that they did not. At bottom, all forms of industrialization so far have been revolutions from above, the work of a ruthless minority. Well, a revolution from above was taking place in America. The ruthless minority were the capitalists, and they were grinding and driving and essentially changing the whole nature of work for ordinary Americans.
So, John Grinspan, this is one of the things that I think both Jack's book and your book really highlights, is that when we use the broad term of democracy and participation, there is a gap between our conception of that and what government can actually deliver. So I mean, the passions on the street were not reflected in, as Jack just laid it out, the passion for actually progress and change in the halls of state houses and Congress at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And part of it is, as Jack said earlier, these parties aren't great. I mean, one, the Democratic Party is pretty much awful and white supremacist and engage in terrorism. And the other, the Republican Party, are just a little bit less crooked. You know, so it's not like there's a great option out there that if you turn out in mass and vote for them, they're going to solve all their problems. But there's also something weird that happens at the end of this era. Voter turnout crashes dramatically. Essentially, a third of voters stop voting. Goes from 80% in the 1890s down to like 49% by the 1920s. And yet this is the era when so many of the important changes for our lives was made. This is the progressive era when women's suffrage, anti-child labor laws, pure food and drug laws, vaccination campaigns, a lot of the things that really dramatically improved American life happen after people stop turning out in such large numbers? And so that gives us historians a question. It's not the question we want, obviously, because we want turnout to connect to things getting better. But we have this era when you can really make the case that something about the calming that happened in that era enabled those reforms from parties that previously had spent, you know, 30 or 40 years fighting each other and not doing much for working people or ordinary people. So the question introduced to historians is, what does it mean and what happens that turnouts drop so dramatically right as all these positive changes get made? And what does that tell us about democracy?
Okay, I've got this. Folks, this is the wait a minute part of John's book, because, again, I always thought that we should be aiming for higher turnout, and hearing the halcyon days of 80% turnout sounded great to me. But what you're saying is, after this period, our sort of conception of, you know, average normal American voter turnout was really, you know, that 50% or so was a crashing drop. But it happened because people were, you called it a calming, John, but your book uses much more specific language. I mean, cities basically just stopped allowing people to gather in giant public rallies. They closed places. You talked about saloons on election day. So it made it harder for working class voters to gather and talk. I mean, it sounds like a concerted effort to disenfranchise people from their democracy.
Yeah. And this is also the same era where in southern states, Jim Crow state constitutions are making it nearly impossible for African-Americans to vote who'd been voting in large numbers previously. So this is not a fixing. This is not a calming and everything is cleaned up. I mean, one of the really interesting things about this era is how messy it is, how all these reforms are passed. There's a general calming. People stop shooting each other over politics and partisanship falls. It all goes along in this era when it gets harder to – nearly impossible to vote for African-Americans the South. And in the majority of the country, because there's a big northern majority this time, it gets a lot harder for immigrants to vote, working class people to vote, people who don't know how to read. It gets a lot harder if you don't have literacy or you can't read English to vote. Young people stop turning out in the high numbers they'd previously been. So this is this really messy, confusing thing we have where politics, if you go back to 30,000 feet, you can say, oh, they calmed down. You know, there aren't as many assassinations as there used to be. There aren't as many election riots or frauds. But it's also partially dependent on this dramatic fall in participation. Part of it is, honestly, I don't want to sound too conspiratorial, but really a scheme from certain classes, wealthier classes in society, to end working class public engagement. They don't love turnout. They don't like these big marches where, you know, bricklayers and stevedores and whatnot are deciding who should the next governor should be. So a lot of the things we've benefited from come hand in hand with things that are really ugly. And all our worries about turnout over the last century are born from this era where they make this dramatic change from valuing participation to valuing civility.
Jack, can you help explain this? Because as John points out, it's in this period, this crashing of turnout, where for the first time class become – wealth and education become correlated with turnout. And as fewer Americans vote, as he says – progressive reforms are finally able to pass in Congress and other legislatures. I mean, I just explained that, Jack.
Well, it's making the country safe for the middle classes. Uh-huh. They can vote. They vote. They get what they want. The poor, the laborers, as John points out, they're shunned. They're driven out of the electorate, with, of course, all African Americans in the South. And effectively, the party of non-voters, as Walter Dean Burnham has called the shape of the American political universe, a system where nearly half the people never vote, that took shape then. And Burnham, in his writings, points out that parties socialize and as it were, domesticate political appetites. Bad as they are, they get people politically socialized, that they can, you know, they can feel connected to something. Dangerous is the situation where you have millions who are not tied to any party and who are available for the demagogue, available for the gust of passion. And that haunts American politics now as it really did for most of this century. When the non-voters vote, are they going to make us a social democracy as in Europe, Or will they take us in a darker direction?
Right. So John, this is exactly why I think, to put a bright line under it, this is not one of the lessons from the close of the Gilded Age that you think we ought to be applying now, because there's so many key differences. People look upon efforts at voter disenfranchisement now as one of the greatest affronts to American democracy. And to Jack's point about making room for the middle class, perhaps at the turn of the 20th century, at this point in time in America, the middle class has also undergone a 40-year period of being hollowed out. So what is the lesson that you draw from that crashing of participation?
Yeah, and I don't want to sound like I'm cheering any of that. I mean, as a historian, it's interesting to see how things change. I'm not advocating for any of that. I think if there is a positive lesson and an optimistic lesson of this era, it's that people were able to look at their democracy and identify the flaws and make fundamental change to how people were behaving. Now some of that was good, and you turn out and partisanship falls, violence falls. In a lot of ways, I'd rather vote in the 20th century than the 19th century, right? Like, this is a system that gave us the norms we know and we're worried about defending today. And a lot of that was bad. It does involve disenfranchisement, suppression. But what's really important, I think, to take away in the 20th century is that deliberate self-conscious change is possible. It's not that we're inevitably hurtling towards civil war and Armageddon, and that's kind of the only outcome here. People can self-consciously form movements to dramatically change politics based really on changing the political culture. Not that many laws change in the late 19th century. Some do, but they're not huge. They're not enough to explain the huge cultural change. Reformers are able to change how people talk about democracy, how people engage with democracy, and really remake in some fundamental ways our political system successfully. So I think if there's anyone we want to look at as, you know, showing us lessons for today, it's not the changes they make, but that they were able to do it at all.
Jack, reforming how people talk about democracy, that brings to mind the poem about William Jennings Bryan that you helped launch the show with. I mean, is there more from the poem that we might bring back here at the end of the program?
Yes, defeat. Bryan was the only candidate in this period who challenged the plutocracy. He was a fusion candidate, Democrat, populist. He wanted to nationalize the railroads. He was outspent 10-1. And here we are, election night at midnight. Boy, Bryan's defeat. Defeat of Western silver. Defeat of the wheat. Victory of the neat. Defeat of the aspen groves of Colorado valleys. The blue bells of the Rockies and blue bonnets of old Texas by the Pittsburgh alleys. Defeat of alfalfa and the Mariposa lily. Defeat of the Pacific and the long Mississippi. Defeat of the young by the old and silly. Defeat of tornadoes by the poison vats supreme. Defeat of my boyhood. Defeat of my dream.
What do you hear in that sad finish to the poem, Jack?
Well, just this moment that American politics looked like it could change, but progressivism came too soon. You know, it was, the country wasn't ready for that, and you know, the New York Times ran articles by graphologists claiming they could tell Bryan's insanity by his handwriting. I mean, and companies all over the country kicked into boodle kitties to outspend Bryan everywhere. And yet he rallied millions of voters, and he spoke, as I said, as I try to say in my book, to the politics of the future, to the New Deal, to a time when average people, when the government can become about them and not the few.
Right. So, John Greenspan, we have about a minute or so left to go here. Picking up on that, another sort of, I don't know if this is how much of a difference this is, but I'm hearing you talk a lot about how to pull hope from this idea that we can change at least how people talk about politics, if not the politics themselves. But where is that pressure going to come from? I don't really see the parties, once again, wanting to do that because they're benefiting from extreme partisanship. We also have the problem of technology spreading the very kind of passions and language that you say are work against the calming of a democracy. So what do we do?
I think it's going to come from our culture. I think you're exactly right that the parties, neither party is going to solve this problem. There's no landslide victory that's going to calm everyone down. There's no campaign. There's no candidate that's going to do it. And I don't think there are legal fixes we can make to make things better, but that's not how you fundamentally change a political culture. I think it's going to come from how we talk to each other, how we engage, how we talk about politics, think about politics, deal with each other. I think one of the things that this working on this book has borne out to me is that democracy is bigger and more receptive and responsive in some ways to popular culture and how we deal with each other than I thought it was. And we can actually reform our political system by changing how we as individuals in mass participate in it.
Well, John Grinspan is a curator at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History and author of The Age of Acrimony, How Americans Fought to Fix Their Democracy, 1865 to 1915. Thank you so much for joining us, John.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst. His book is The Age of Betrayal, The Triumph of Money in America, 1865 to 1900. Jack, always such a pleasure. Thank you, Jack.
Thank you, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken? Wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.